When it comes to bourbon, Brooklyn resident Reed Mittenbuehler is giving it to us straight up. Mittenbuehler's written a book about bourbon. It's called Bourbon Empire, The Past and Future of America's Whiskey. I'm George Boraki, and this is Cityscape. Reed Mittenbuehler is with us in the studio. Reed, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what's the difference between bourbon and whiskey?
Well, bourbon is a type of whiskey. All bourbon is whiskey. Not all whiskey is bourbon. You know, it's kind of like wine. You've got Chardonnays, Pinot Noirs, all these different styles. And bourbon is just its own style of whiskey. So you have scotch, which is made primarily from malted barley, and it's aged a little bit differently. And bourbon is uniquely American style of whiskey, primarily made from corn, at least 51%, but usually it tips up into about 75%. The rest of the, we call the mash bill, the recipe, is usually rye. It can be wheat, but it can be anything the distiller wants. They have their choice of grains, and usually a little bit of malted barley. And then you cook it, you grind it up, you cook it, and you make kind of a beer, absent the lightly bitter flavor of hops. And then you distill it, and you get a very high proof alcohol. It's clear, and then you put that into a barrel, a charred new oak barrel, and then you age it. And that's where it gets its color. And most
how
of
long is it aged, typically?
Typically, I mean, that's up to the distiller, and that varies. I mean, in order to be called bourbon, it just has to touch that barrel. In order to be called straight whiskey, it's a couple years in the barrel. To really get into its zone of excellence, I like to say, usually the better part of a decade, 5 to 10 years. You can go older, especially in recent years. People have kind of gone after these oak bomb bourbons, things that have been sitting around in the barrel for a really, really long time. But sometimes those can actually be ruined. It can get too woody from the tannins. Back in the 70s, a lot of distillers actually told me a lot of that stuff, in some cases, was actually destroyed. You know, they were like, oh, it's ruined. You know, today you can see it fetching a high price simply because it's old, not necessarily good. But, you know, there's kind of this sweet spot where the flavor of the grains is balanced with the flavor of the wood.
Is it true that bourbon distillers can only use their barrels once?
Right. It's got to be a charred new oak barrel. And there's a big resale market for those barrels. They're sold a lot of times overseas to scotch makers, or they're sold to any kind of company that's aging. It can be wine, whatever, aging in an old barrel. With bourbon, that's the reason it's a little bit darker usually and sweeter. There's a lot of oomph in that. It's like using a tea bag for the first time, you know, a big flavor wallet.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with scotch, you'll notice it's usually a little bit more pale. And that's because, I mean, malted, you know, barley, when you distill it, it's a little more subtle. So you almost kind of want a used barrel. The aging, the climate conditions overseas over there are usually a little more mild too.
I was going to say, I've read that the weather during the aging process affects the taste of bourbon.
It's very important, and also where the barrel sits in the warehouse. So when you're in the Midwest, where most of this stuff is made, the Ohio River Valley states, Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana, you have these drastic climate changes where it gets really cold in the winter and it's hot in the summer. And as the barrel sits there, the liquid is pushed into that wood, and then it comes back out when the weather gets a little bit colder. And if it's sitting, usually these rack houses, typically, not always, but they're about 5 stories high. So if you're on a high floor, the whiskey can age many times faster than it does on a very low floor. So when you do see some of these older bourbons, like 15, 16 years, which is considered very old, usually they probably sat on the low floor. On one of the upper floors, it's probably evaporated by that time. On the low floors, it's a little less evaporation because a little less heat, and it greatly affects the flavor. It's a huge, huge difference.
You referenced a few states there where bourbon is made, but why is bourbon so closely associated with Kentucky in particular?
Right. So a subplot of the history of American whiskey is a story of consolidation. And you have American whiskey production in the 19th century is going on all over the country. I mean, there's all sorts of places that have the right climate, and they grow grain well, and they're close to water sources. You had booming whiskey economies in places like New York and Maryland. Typically, they were growing, they were making rye whiskey if they're on the East Coast, because rye grows well. And then as Americans drifted west into the frontier, you start to see more corn. So they just worked that into the mix. It was a very pragmatic decision. And you have farmers on the frontier, and they couldn't get their grains always to market. You didn't have canals or road structures and that kind of thing. So in the early days of whiskey, they were actually using it as a way to store the value of their grains, and they used it as currency. It was trading, and they weren't drinking all of it. So you see these parts of America start to emerge as distilling centers. Often it really wasn't by choice. It wasn't like these guys were craftsmen, like, this is my craft and we do this well. It was really by necessity. They were farmers and they were just looking for a way to preserve the value of their work. And that happened in all of these states that you see, you know, in today's Midwest, Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. Before Prohibition, there were still hundreds of distilleries. But by the time you get to the year 2000, you've got 8 companies, 13 plants. And they had largely consolidated to Kentucky, which does it very, very well. Tennessee is another big center. You know, in the book we explain there's a lot of reasons for this. Religion is a reason. You know, you've got a lot of... There was still a lot of dry activism after Prohibition. A lot of Prohibitionists were still fighting to keep alcohol out of their counties and out of their local communities, and say local option laws. So you saw a lot of places, especially in Tennessee, where there were once thriving distilling industries shutting down or not really returning. You know, and the part of Kentucky that today produces about 95% of all the world's bourbon historically was always kind of this Catholic enclave. It had been a place for Catholics, largely from Maryland. It's kind of a place, you know, I say in the book, where they sent the sons who had been born under the pile of older brothers. You know, it was this place where they ended up, and it was the archdiocese for all Catholic matters west of the Alleghenies. And they were a little more tolerant, you know, towards alcohol, towards distilling. So that allowed this one little chunk of Kentucky to kind of gain prominence. You know, it was never fought against there. And there's a lot of different economic reasons, cultural reasons, and they all kind of come together in this confluence. And that was one of the things I really wanted to explore in the book is, you know, how this product, treated as a commodity, you know, it's kind of a business history, has helped shape the economic and political history of the United States.
Parallels it, if you will.
It parallels it, and it also did help shape it. And also, as the economy of the U.S. changed, as politics changed, you also see this thing as a product changing. You know, you see people starting to lobby for it, which change the regulations on how it's made, and all these things come together, and it becomes this really great American story of industry. And it's got all the great parts of that whole story. You've got, you know, parts of it's very charming. You've got craft. You've got innovation.
You've got corruption.
And then on the flip side, you've got corruption. It's historically one of the most corrupt industries in American history. And even today, you still see some questionable marketing and that sort of thing. So it's really kind of a lovely story in both ways. It's got just enough of that kind of dicey aspect to make it sort of exciting. And I still think it's very relevant. And it's also got this story of craft and a foodie story that people can also be drawn to.
Can't we thank whiskey for some of our consumer protection laws today?
Absolutely. Right. The 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, whiskey was an important part of that. It was landmark reform legislation. Teddy Roosevelt was sort of behind it. And a big driving force on it was meatpacking. You know, I mean, you'd show up and meatpacking plants. It was, you know, this Egyptian plague of flies, you know, on piles of rancid meat, and you had people getting sick from it and that sort of thing. And the whiskey industry was actually very similar. You had two parts of the industry. One part that was making the product, as we would sort of recognize it today, a good quality product. But you also had a part of the industry that was highly corrupt. There were no labeling or trademark regulations in place. So as soon as you started to see a producer, such as, you know, E.H. Taylor with his old Taylor brand, coming up with a product that was really good, it was well made, it was respected, they would try to mimic it by, you know, they'd throw poisons into it and they'd burn sugar and all these kind of things, you know, to kind of mimic the effects of aging. And then they'd use his brand name. So he's lighting up the courts at this time, you know, fighting this kind of stuff. In 1897, you had the Bottling and Bond Act, which made the U.S. government the guarantor of whiskey's quality, put all these regulations around it, labeling regulations. And then in 1906, that legislation was actually delayed for about 2 years by the whiskey question. It was a huge industry. It was responsible for between a third, almost half of the United States government's revenue through taxes, either through domestic production or through tariffs of imported spirits. So, you know, it was important and people wanted to get this right. And you had this sort of corrupt part of the industry arguing against these regulations, you know, how they should label their product and that sort of thing. And then you had a smaller group that was arguing, you know, on behalf of them, and they battled about this, and it went all the way to Taft's White House. You know, it was like, what are we going to call this stuff? And you see a lot of the labeling designations that are in place today determined during this time.
Talking about labeling, you've said that you should not believe 90% of the tales you read on whiskey bottles.
Right. They're great stories, you know, and that's the fun part of it. I actually love the stories, and they're fun, and they're also fun to sort of make fun of. You know, when you look at the marketing behind this stuff, people want the sense that their brand is old. You know, if it's been around this long, it's got to be good. So you see these stories about the frontier, about my great grandfather's ancient recipe, and almost none of them are true. A lot of them are just made up wholesale, you know, just out of thin air. You know, people want to see that sepia tone thing. And so you've got this great extra subplot in the history of American whiskey of all these salesmen just coming up with this stuff. And what I found when I was doing the research is that the stories behind those stories were often way more interesting. You know, when you look at, you know, the story that's presented, it's usually one of hearth and home and of craft. And, you know, this old distiller got up every day and just kind of, you know, turned these grains into whiskey. But then when you look at some of these guys, it's like they were ruthless, shrewd businessmen. And I love another subplot I love to explore in the book is the one of how they're taking a very, what I think, humble, simple product. It's just some grains, fermented, distilled, and just stored in a barrel for a little while. And they're trying to make it seem fancier. It's a great business story. And that way they can charge more for it. And you've got all kinds of just wild advertising, you know, campaigns. And these guys are always confronted by this problem. How can we take this hillbilly juice and, you know, make it seem something greater than it is, uh-huh. You know, seem fancy? And so it's just so funny to see how they do that. And there's a character I use, you know, in the book, Louis Rosenstiel, who some estimate in the 50s had controlled, you know, about half of all the aged stocks of whiskey in the United States. And he had one story shortly after repeal. He had trained something like 5,000 parrots to say, "Drink Old Quaker," you know, and he hands them out to bartenders. And this advertising campaign erupted in all the sort of disastrous ways you'd imagine it would.
He also got the ear of Congress, didn't he, Lewis?
Oh, huge lobbying force there. Yeah, you know, he's funny. You know, there's that old saying that behind every great American success story lies, you know, a great crime and that sort of thing. And Louis Rosenstiel, you won't see his picture on a bottle of bourbon, but, you know, I argue in the book he's one of the most important and influential figures in the industry, especially in the 20th century. When you're tasting this product, you are tasting the result of his business acumen, of his lobbying. You know, he got his start during Prohibition, so really got a leg up in the industry. He was indicted, although never convicted, on bootlegging charges. It was later revealed he had connections to guys like Meyer Lansky and that sort of thing. And he had this office here in New York in the Empire State Building, you know, wearing really nice suits. Not the image you see in the bottle of a guy in overalls or anything like that. But in the 1950s, he was confronted by this business problem. That's how I opened the book, actually. You know, bourbon has this nickname as America's native spirit. And I was like, what's that mean? Like, what is our native spirit? Like, what? It's like, well, it's a story of business. It's a story of capitalism. So here he is, Louis Rosenstiel. And in the run-up to the Korean War, he was worried that the whiskey industry was going to suffer drastic shortages like it had suffered during World War II. So he orders his distillers to produce at full blast. And it's like, takes stocks of whiskey in the country past like 637 million gallons. The Korean War ends without the shortages he expected, and he's got all of this whiskey. It's literally evaporating in the thin air, you know, as it ages. Consumer demand was very strong in the U.S., but he's got so much. He needs to sell this stuff. He's losing his profit. So he goes to his counterparts. There are four companies that controlled about 75% of the entire industry, and he goes to them. And he's like, we need to change the bonding rules, you know, for taxation on this stuff. When it comes due in 8 years, I'm going to have to sell probably at a loss. You're going to have to sell to compete. It's going to wipe out huge portions of this industry. The industry is way bigger than it is today. Lots of tax revenue. This is a big deal. You know, the New York Times ran this big headline, whiskey industry facing a crisis. It was serious stuff. And although the regulations he was proposing were good for the industry, these other guys like Seagram, you know, Sam Bronfman at Seagram and Hiram Walker and National, they kind of balk. They're like, well, it's going to help you, but it's not really going to help us. And this is a big complaint from business press at the time about these guys could never really seem to work together. So he just goes off on his own, forms this rogue lobbying organization, and he gets Congress to pass it. And he's also in charge of the resolution in 1964, that the congressional resolution declaring bourbon a distinctive product of the United States, which since then has been sort of reimagined by the marketers as, oh, this was, you know, it's like a Valentine's Day card on behalf of Congress to a grateful American public, you know, and this product, you know, represents all these wonderful American ideals, which it does. But really, he was looking to get it labeled that way, the same way that champagne is designated a unique product of that region of France, mm-hmm. or cognac or tequila, so he could press into overseas markets. And that resolution declared it something that could only be made in the United States. I guess it was invented here, and it's a fair call. But it also protected him from overseas competitors, both in his domestic market and abroad. So it's kind of this much more interesting, you know, and kind of shrewd business story than it is the thing that it's been imagined since.
You're listening to Cityscape. I'm George Bodarkey. With us in the studio is Brooklyn resident Reed Mittenbuehler. He's here to talk about his new book, Bourbon Empire, The Past and Future of America's Whiskey. So bourbon's a distinctive product of the United States, but is it officially America's native spirit?
So the language in the resolution is a distinctive product of the United States, and then it often gets misquoted as America's native spirit. There was a follow-on bill several years ago to declare September National Bourbon Month. And, you know, when they were referencing back to the 1964 resolution, they even misquoted it then, the Kentucky senator who introduced it. You know, so that's a great lesson in how myths kind of become, you know, what they are. You know, like the story of Paul Bunyan or the Headless Horseman or whatever. You take this kernel of truth in the beginning and it grows into this kind of magical thing, like all of our great stories and myths. So I opened the book with that story just because I thought it captured a lot of those themes.
Where does bourbon get its name?
Well, that is up for debate. And you have this section of Kentucky called Bourbon County, which when the area that is today Kentucky was still part of Virginia, the whole thing was, you know, Bourbon County. You know, it's easy to kind of say, well, it was named after that, you know, on a distillery tour in the state that today is where the industry is entirely consolidated. But when I was going through old records, and you look at New Orleans, it's one of the biggest cities in the nation at the time, big French-speaking population, and that was one of the biggest markets for this stuff. You also had a big French connection in Louisville, Kentucky. So these middleman merchants, Tarascon brothers, to name a couple of them, and they had come from France where, you know, they would have been familiar with the ways of making cognac, you know, which is aged in a charred barrel as well. You know, people had long known, going back to ancient times, that these liquids stored in a charred barrel, you know, taste better over time. And as you're shipping them down to places like New Orleans, they're just going to get a little bit better as they sit in the barrel and they age. Most whiskey at the time was consumed locally. You'd have these kind of regional colloquial names such as, you know, Bardstown whiskey or Loretta, you know, just kind of whatever kind of name. It was known as just whiskey. It was treated like a commodity. It didn't have, you didn't have brand names for the most part before the Civil War. But when you're down in New Orleans, big cities were some of the few places where they would still actually import from very far abroad. So, you know, there's kind of a debate about exactly where the name came from. I think it really was this kind of marketing tool. You've got your biggest market down in New Orleans, and you've got Bourbon Street, and there are all these stories about how, you know, it got its name from people asking for that kind of whiskey they serve on Bourbon Street. Mm-hmm. Coming from a place that did have a county, you know, named Bourbon, and all of those names, you know, in Kentucky, it came from the fact that during the American Revolution, the French had supported the rebels. And so you have all these places in Kentucky that are named after the French, all these town names that kind of come from that era. And so, you know, in a way, it does trace all the way back to the French monarchy because they had supported the Americans in their cause when they were fighting the British, who are huge enemies of the French. So it's another way that this also is kind of America's native spirit. You know, the name is connected in that way to the Revolution and to frontier expansion and all these kinds of things. And when you weave them together into a story, it kind of creates this, it's kind of quilt, really. It's a wonderful story, you know, where you see all these kind of tangential parts of American history all coming together and touching this one product.
What inspired your interest in bourbon?
You know, in the beginning, it's that kind of foodie thing. You know, you get interested in this subject the way that people get interested in wine or beer or bacon, you know, whatever. And I started, you know, geeking out on it a little bit, and I was looking for books on it, and there were a lot of guides, and these were quite good. You know, they do ratings, and they explain very literally what it is how, you know, how it's made, and have very brief history sections. I was always drawn to those history sections. And then you start to see how it touches American history, how it's influenced it, how it's been influenced. And you'd hear people say things like, oh, it's a story, it's Shakespearean, but I didn't really see it in a book, and I was like, well, maybe that's my book to write, you know? So, you know, I wanted to look at it. I wanted to kind of take a little bit of the romance out of it that you kind of see in a lot of food writing, you know, where it's very, you know, it's very sentimental and that kind of thing, and look at it as the spirit of the frontier, this base of capitalism, you know, a word that's beautiful to some, dirty to others. And, you know, in the beginning of the book, we anchor a lot of this in the Whiskey Rebellion of George Washington's time. You know, and you see that event, it's kind of this battle between the policies of Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson to define the soul of American business in a lot of ways. And you still see that debate echo today, you know, big versus small. You know, you've got Hamilton, who is supporting larger consolidated industries on the East Coast, which were going to operate kind of at the detriment of these smaller frontier producers. And today you've got the reemergence of a craft movement. You know, you're always seeing this push and pull between big and small. And that erupts, very literally erupts, in a rebellion in 1794, where you've got these small distillers who feel like they're losing out to the large East Coast distillers because of Alexander Hamilton's policies to tax this product. And they threaten to secede from the nation. They've got their own flag. They're using, they're recycling the language of the French in their revolution, you know, calling one leader of the rebellion, call himself the Robespierre of the West, and saying we need to guillotine our leaders on the East Coast, you know, that sort of thing. And it all kind of centered around whiskey. And what's funny is that even the term whiskey rebellion was coined by Alexander Hamilton as a way to kind of diminish a lot of these larger things that the frontier was fighting over, you know, losing their independence to Eastern finance men, mm-hmm. you know, and that sort of thing. And, you know, when you take stories like that and you frame the history of this industry through that, you know, the story just kind of emerges and evolves. And it was a lot of fun just to kind of trace and explore and still work in that modern foodie element, you know, but also kind of look at it as, you know, a very important force in American history.
Because so much of the history of bourbon is based on legend and lies, if you will, how challenging was the research for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there are these old books and some of these old texts, and you have to double, triple check, you know, everything. It all becomes a lot more clear when you do look at it purely as a commodity, and you start moving away from the companies and their stories, you know, about how this brand emerged, you know, and that sort of thing. And then it actually gets a lot easier when you almost look at it as, you know, data and that sort of thing. And there are old trade records from how this stuff was traded on the frontier and old distilling manuals. And then a lot of it is just an exploration of, instead of getting to the very bottom of this thing, just looking at all the different answers, you know, that have emerged. A lot of the stories behind some of these brands, this was a thrill to kind of explore, have changed over time. The company would say, oh, well, this is the reason our brand is named this way. And then a few decades later, it's like, well, this is the reason, or this. And then somebody else buys it, and you see the story changing. And in that way, it's very American. You know, we have this notion of history that's a little slippery. It's kind of like, you know, you kind of change it to suit the times and fads and fashions and things like that. So, you know, the book, there's a lot of commentary in it. So there's commentary about that kind of stuff. What's this say about us and our sense of history? You know, right now, today, with the boom in the popularity of whiskey, you have a lot of lawsuits, tons of lawsuits. Just in the last couple months, you know, some have been closed, some have opened. And I was looking at them the other day. I was like, you know, a lot of them are about heritage, and it's about one company that really has no real connection to the brand that's on its label today, but they just bought an old trademark. It'll be a, you know, a marketing firm in New York, and they just bought the trademark to some brand in Pennsylvania or whatever. They don't really have a real hold on that heritage. And then you've got a company that maybe is located in Pennsylvania down the street or whatever, you know, from where the distiller is, and they don't really have a real connection to it either, but now they're suing each other, you know, so it's like, heritage to us today, history, isn't this real thing, this truly authentic thing. It's just, who can you beat in a court of law over a trademark, you know, that someone pulled out of a file cabinet somewhere? So that's a, I might get a little cynical there, but that's another part of the story that I thought was important to examine. It's huge in the industry today. Because that idea, heritage, authenticity, I think that's what people are really buying. It's what they're buying into, literally and figuratively. They want that. And it sells this product. You know, this product is as much a part of the storytelling business as it is the booze business.
You mentioned the popularity of whiskey today, whiskey experiencing huge sales, probably its greatest sales since the 1960s, right?
Yes.
Why do you think that's the case?
There's a couple of factors. So when whiskey cratered in the 60s and 70s, you have the boomers who are coming of age, and they were, you know, whiskey had been very popular before them, and it was the drinks of their fathers and their grandfathers and their grandfathers, you know, going all the way back. And, you know, they rejected it the way that a lot of young generations reject what came immediately before. They turned to the white spirits like vodka, and they turned to wine and those kinds of things. You know, whiskey had come to be seen as old-fashioned. It was kind of fuddy, you know, it was kind of, you know, it was old. So, you know, they rejected it for the new. And today, I think you've got a new generation of drinkers who sees those other drinks almost as kind of old, you know, and they're rejecting it for the new. And this is new again. It's the new thing after being the old thing. And I think nostalgia is also a very important part of that. When you look at the labels and you see the iconography on them, you know, going back to the frontier, you know, it's reimagined as a simpler time. It's imagined, you know, as kind of this wellspring of all these American virtues, you know, pragmatism, practicality, guts. It's the frontier. And I think when people look at this stuff, there's something that seems simpler about that. It really wasn't simpler, but it seems simpler. And today, you know, in the book, I get a little whimsical perhaps, but, you know, I say, these are confusing times. Everyone says that about whatever time they're living in. But, you know, economically, you've got all these industry tearing asunder the old industries and replacing them with inequality. You know, politically, we've got, you know, a meritocracy. You've got these people who are elected, but they're also, you know, it's more shrill in Washington than it's ever been. Technology has changed our way of life in a lot of ways. It has been very positive. You know, it's connected us in a lot of positive ways, but there's also been a downside to that. I think it's disconnected in us in a lot of ways, and you're staring at the numb glow of tiny screens all the time, that kind of thing. And I think that this product, you know, it looks to, you know, anchored in that romanticized past, there's a pull for that. And I think that that also partly explains it. And, you know, it tastes good. I think it tastes better in vodka. So.
What's your bourbon of choice?
Oh, boy. I get asked that a lot, and I feel like I always disappoint people a little bit with this. You know, you write a book on this, and I've gotten to try a lot of extraordinary bottles. I've gotten to try a lot of what are called dusties, you know, bottles that are many decades old. And, you know, people ask you that, and they want a little bit of advice. They almost expect something that's kind of esoteric. You're going to unlock a secret for them. You know, it's like you've gone to the mountaintop, and there's this old man, and he kind of bestowed some secret on you. Can you now pass the secret on to me? I'm like, honestly, a lot of these bottles on the shelves that aren't that expensive, as I said, you know, by its nature, it's a very humble, kind of simple product. That it's like the perfect peach. It reaches perfection in a relatively simple state. That's kind of the great secret, is these very ubiquitous everyday brands, I think, offer so much value for the money. And it's kind of an ideal, not just for whiskey, but, you know, in a lot of other ways. You know, we talk about the way that the spirit parallels American history and has lessons about American values. I think that that's also kind of an important one. So, you know, a lot of times I keep these brands like Old Grandad, you know, 100 Proof, or, you know, Maker's Mark, which has come ubiquitous, or, you know, Buffalo Trace, these kinds of things. Those kind of sit on my shelf, and I keep going back to them because they're good value, and they you know, if you were to blind taste test them, and I've seen this done, I've done this, a lot of times they beat out, you know, the really expensive brands by a mile. You know, that's the other lesson in the book, is a lot of this stuff is all in our heads. It's the marketing that's created around it. As I said, you've got these folks who have always tried to find ways to make it seem more fancy so they can get you to pay more for it. And in the 50s, the New York Times had done this piece about how people were taking the same liquid and just putting it in fancier bottles, you know, and jacking up the price. You know, and today you'll see these terms like small batch and these things that kind of tap in today's modern foodie movement, you know, that I think trigger something in our brains that make us reach for our wallets. Mm-hmm. Although they don't really mean anything. Those terms aren't regulated. They're not really defined. They're just random words thrown onto a bottle. And so you'll see, you know, folks doing that. And you're like, honestly, just look past all that noise. And remember, you know, life's simple pleasures that are kind of the most special. And that's the true same thing for whiskey, I think.
Reed, thank you so much for coming in.
All right, thank you very much.
Reed Mittenbuehler's new book, Bourbon Empire, The Past and Future of America's Whiskey, is out now from Viking Books. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. Past episodes of the show are available in our archives at wfuv.org/cityscape. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter for show updates and New York City tidbits. I'm George Bodarkey. My thanks to producers Taylor Nulk and Claire Drake.
It's WFUV and WFUV HD, New York. Listener-supported public media from Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York. Music discovery starts here.